Namo dasa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another evening with the Clear Mountain Monastery community. I'm happy to say that I'm now up in Seattle. I've finished my degree at the Dharma Realm Buddhist University, and I'm very grateful for the time I spent there. I'm grateful for the teachers, I'm grateful for the support, and grateful for the things I learned, the books I read, and all of the many different factors that went into making my experience there. It's a Mahayana university. It's situated in Ukiah, California, in the city of 10,000 Buddhas, a Chinese Mahayana university that was originally founded by Master Xuanhua, who offered the land for Abhayagiri. And there's been a very warm and close relationship with Abhayagiri ever since. So what I've been doing these last three or four sessions that I've led here on these evening Wednesdays nights is doing somewhat of a retrospective and looking back at those 4 years and seeing what insights I might be able to take and glean and digest and bring from all those times, all those classes, all those books, all those sutras into my practice and some of these teachings, which are primarily geared towards Theravada practitioners, but really any practice which helps us to get rid of greed, anger, and delusion is a worthy practice. And the Buddha said as much. So, yeah, what can we take from these different teachings, different traditions? So I've been going through, I had a talk about a Guanyin practice, perhaps a Theravada Guanyin approach. So bringing compassion and emptiness and even perhaps a mantra, Guanyin mantra into practice. Spoke about attachment to right views or attachment to Theravada views, which is certainly something which I experienced a lot of, and any insights I had there were more of an epiphenomenon, not really a result of a class that I took or books that I read, but more just being put face to face with views that I didn't know what to think about. And tonight I'll continue with a topic which I think can be interesting to broach on a number of levels, and that is the concept of Pure Land. So I titled this talk Theravada Pure Lands, and primarily I'll be just giving an overview of Suddhavasa, which are literally the pure abodes, what they are. They do appear in a Theravada context. What is Sukhavati, or the land of ultimate bliss, which is the basis for Pure Land practice in Mahayana Buddhism. And also we'll be going into a discourse about, it's called Reappearance by Aspiration. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 120, where this is a Theravada Sutta in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha goes into the dynamics of just how one can do this. So the process of influencing one's future births, which is the whole concept of Pure Land Buddhism, speaking in a certain way, that does have precedence, and it does have an early example in this sutta of the Pali Canon. First of all, Ajahn Nisibu and I both on this channel love for everything to be practical. So what can you do about these teachings right now? How does this have anything to do with your life, especially if you don't believe in rebirth at all? A lot of what I'll be talking about tonight does assume a belief in rebirth, or it just presents from a Buddhist perspective, Theravada perspective, and a Mahayana perspective, the implications of that belief and what one can do to influence future births, if that is, as the Buddha says, is the case, that is, samsara is a real thing, and birth in different forms occurs through the course of samsaric wandering. But just on a practical level, there's somewhat of a beautiful chant, which I'd like to just introduce in the beginning. I'll chant it in Pali, and then I'll chant it in English as well. And I think it does a good job of introducing this concept, even if all you believe in is this life, and all you're concerned about is this present moment. There's even a place for seeing how this this wish can be part of your own practice. So this occurs in many, or pretty much most, all Thai chanting books. So Thai people will be familiar with it. It's chanted at the beginning or at the end of morning recitation in many Thai forest monasteries. I believe the chant, I'd heard somewhere that it was attributed to King Rama IV of Thailand, but I also heard that it's done in Sri Lanka as well, so it might predate Rama IV, so be even earlier than the mid-1800s. So it doesn't go back as far as the Pali Canon, but it does have, I believe the principles are consonant with that. So Pali first. And this is just part of what we call the transference of merit, or the dedication of merit, which you can find in the Amaravati chanting book. So I'll jump in about halfway through, after we've done this dedication to our teachers and to our parents and our relatives and all beings. It comes this wish for ourself. So Imina punya kamena imina udisena chake paha sulabe che vatanu pada na chedana ye santane hina dhamma yavani banato mama na santu sabada ye vayata jato bhave bhave uju chitta satipanya sale ko viriyamina mara labantu no kasa katincha viriye sume. So that's some beautiful Pali, and you can look online and find it chanted even more beautifully by there you could probably find it, dedication of merit, in many different forms. And the English is, through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. So again, that's just the middle section of this longer chant, but it touches on a number of principles which we'll be going into tonight. So just there at the end, it talks about weakening my resolve. And in the Pali there, it's just virya, so weaken my energy, the energy that I'm putting forward. And that is one thing which is different about the Suddhavasa, the pure abodes. I'll just use that terminology when we're speaking about the Pali context of the heaven realms, the high, fine material heaven realms of the Pali Canon, and the Sukhavati, or the pure lands, the ultimate lands of ultimate bliss of Amitabha Buddha in the Mahayana Canon. But it's a different goal. The virya, the effort which is being exerted in a Theravada context, is for arhatship, for this context of getting rid of all greed and anger within myself and all delusion to the extent of fully noted, fully understanding how I cause myself suffering. So fully understanding the Four Noble Truths. When I do that in a Theravada context, that's the end of ignorance in that context. And what a Buddha does in a Mahayana context is gets rid of all greed and anger internally and works towards the omniscience of a Buddha and is able to help and actually work towards saving or ending, influencing others to get rid of their greed and anger as well. But this wish, which is in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind. In the specifics of that, that you can conceive of it in terms of the present life. In every presently arisen state, in every moment that I can influence, may I just bring as much mindfulness as I can to the practice. That's great. Being in the present moment, the Buddha didn't stop there in either a Theravada or a Mahayana context, but did talk about being able to plan for the future. I spoke about this in another recent talk, but when the Buddha's teaching his son Rahula about giving up, when you're thinking about doing something by body, speech, or mind, Rahula, you should reflect, this act of body, speech, or mind that I'm thinking about doing, will it lead to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both? And when you realize that it's not, then you should do it. And if you realize that it is, then you shouldn't do it. So there is this prospection, this looking into the future as an aspect of Theravada Buddhism, and whether you want to think about that as the very next moment or how you're influencing all the hopefully happy and harmonious moments of the rest of this life, or as we'll see in the Theravada and the Mahayana canon, this principle does, the Buddha says, go into future lives as well. But in every kind of birth, whether that's the birth of the next moment, the next mind moment, or whatever I encounter, this wish for not just pleasure. So it's not a, and this is probably a facile understanding of the heavens of, or the wish for heaven in a Abrahamic religious context. It's oftentimes, certainly the popular conception of the wish for a heavenly birth, to go to heaven, basically, is you want all that good stuff. You want to see beautiful beings and beautiful angels and to hear heavenly sounds and basically just have all your cake and eat it too. Just looking for the pleasures. But one is wishing for, both in all of the contexts of Buddhism, you're wishing for a future birth, in which you're cultivating and maximizing the potential for a context, both in your own mind and in the outer context, which supports your own development of, as it says here, an upright mind, an uju chittang, that you have mindfulness and wisdom and austerity, vigor. And as we'll see in the Reappearance by Aspiration Sutta, the Sankhara Rupa Pati Sutta, that's made specific into five qualities which can influence a practitioner's rebirth. So that, those being faith, a person who has faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, or sadha, sila, sutta, chaga, and panya. Someone who has these qualities can then have an influence on their future birth by aspiration, by sankara, by wish, by making a wish. If you have a certain amount of these five qualities, this Majjhima 120 says, then it can happen. It can happen. You can be reborn in different realms. So, but before I go much further, just for anyone, any diehard Theravada who is getting uncomfortable with any kind of talk about future birth or any kind of encouragement towards being reborn, let me make you feel better with this quote from, I didn't put down the quote, but I believe it's Anguttara 1, verse number 349, something like that. But a very potent simile. So just as even a tiny bit of fecal matter still stinks, so too I don't approve or praise even a tiny bit of continued existence, not even as long as a finger snap. So this is very good Theravada evidence that someone can point to, and might well point to the rest of this video saying, "Monk, dude, what are you talking about encouraging any kind of birth or thinking about future births? The Buddha didn't do that. Theravada Buddha didn't do that. You're supposed to put an end to birth in this life, and that's what the Buddha taught. You're teaching wrong view, etc." So that's your evidence. And that's from the canon. And it's hard to argue with. And the Buddha did, as we'll see, also teach people maybe who aren't ready to hear that. Maybe people who, do still have a wish for heaven. This is a very natural and normal part of life in a Buddhist country, is that not everyone is wishing for Nibbana or Nirvana. You've got a country like Thailand, however, 70 million people, 300,000 monastics, 30,000 monasteries. I didn't, want to try to do the math or give specific numbers, but not everyone can get their mind around what is Nibbana, what is the cessation of becoming. And it's probably the case that majority of practitioners in a country like Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, which are Theravada, where most people do declare themselves to be Theravada practitioners, are seeking a heavenly rebirth. They just can't get their minds around the end of becoming, that this is it. It seems like annihilationism, extinctionism. And the Buddha did have things to teach them as well. There are conditions that you can put into effect that, like these five, which I mentioned earlier, of having faith, practicing virtue, cultivating learning or sutta, practicing generosity and wisdom, and that can have an effect. So, and can lead to heavenly rebirth, including all the way up to the levels of the Deva worlds, the heavenly worlds. So just a bit of context for the Theravada. I've mentioned these Sudhavasa, what are the pure abodes, and these are five levels of rebirth that only occur for an anagami. And I'll just go through this really quickly. This is a non-returner. So through cultivating sila samadhi panya, through cultivating virtue, concentration, and wisdom, you can get rid of the five lower fetters, that is, attachment to personality view, any kind of doubt about the path or doubt about how we cause ourselves suffering, attachment to rites and rituals, and coarse levels of greed and anger. So by getting rid of greed and anger, actually avijja and anger, that is the definition of a non-returner. So when a non-returner dies, if they don't achieve arhatship in the interim, so after they die, then being reborn, they get reborn in one of these Sudhavasas, like these five heavenly worlds, in which they will attain arhatship in that world. And it's just the best of the best. It's the best place to be because they'll attain arahantship. And from a Theravada point of view, it said that bodhisattvas, and this is, it's not said in the earliest strata of the canon, but it is an accurate, you know, based on the logic of Theravada, it makes sense that a bodhisattva could not be reborn could not be born in the Suddhavasa, these pure abodes of Theravada, because a bodhisattva is intending to be reborn, or is intending to become a Buddha. And according to a Theravada understanding, Buddhas have to be born human. And Suddhavasa, pure abode devas, are not human. They can take the form of a human. And you do find that stories of Suddhavasa, pure abode devas coming to the Buddha with questions. And there's actually one story where this one particular deva appears before the Buddha and he's kind of sinking into the earth, and the Buddha tells him to manifest a material form so that he can hear, that they can actually stand on the earth and talk to the Buddha. Theravada understanding, you have to be a human to become a Buddha, and one is not reborn in the Suddhavasa. That's the final birth, so that precludes becoming a Buddha from a Theravada point of view in the pure abodes. What is Sukhavati? Sukhavati, literally Sukha, bliss or happiness. Avati, or Vat, this is Vat is the place of bliss, the land of bliss, ultimate bliss, or also called the Vishuddha Buddha Kshetra, Buddha Keta, the field of a Buddha, which is Vishuddha, totally pure. And there are three main Mahayana sutras which talk about this pure land. And one of them is the shorter discourse on the pure land, in which is chanted every evening in Chinese one day and then in English the other at the city of 10,000 Buddhas. And this is very much the case in many Mahayana monasteries, that's the primary sutta that will be chanted. And really, Pure Land Buddhism is probably the biggest, largely speaking, sect or type of Buddhism that's practiced in the world. So Pure Land Buddhism is a Dharma door, a method of practicing the Buddha's teaching, which is probably practiced by more people than any other way of practicing Buddhism. Why is that? Because it's very approachable. And why is that? Because what you find in these suttas, these three main Pure Land suttas of the Chinese canon, is a method of practice which is reciting the Buddha's name and recollecting the Buddha, and particularly Amitabha Buddha. So what we find posited and stated in these suttas is that once, when the Blessed One was dwelling in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park, there was a big gathering, this is Chinese Mahayana Sutra, of great disciples like Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Mahakasapa, and many others, and then many other great beings, great bodhisattvas. And there the Buddha says, in a Buddha land, which is many hundreds of thousands of Buddha lands to the west of here, you'll find a Buddha land which is inhabited by or presided over by this Buddha Amitabha Buddha. And the Dharma door, which is put forth in this sutra, is that if one recollects Amitabha Buddha and recites his name, and in Chinese this is usually namo, or homage to Amitabha Buddha, namo Amitofo in Chinese, or namo Amitabutsu in Japanese, and just by reciting the Buddha's name, you are creating affinities with that Buddha in that Buddha land. And this term Buddha Kshetra, or Buddha field, or Fortu, does not appear in the earliest levels of the Pali Canon. It is in commentaries and sub-commentaries. But this concept, so we have a Buddha field, a Buddha, this Buddha land to the west of our Buddha land, which is presided over by Amitabha Buddha, which is basically, he has created this world, which is basically a super place for practicing Dhamma. How it's defined in this sutta is beautiful sights everywhere. There's all sorts of gold and jewels everywhere you look, and you're born from a lotus, and there's no greed, anger, and delusion. And when the wind blows, it rustles the trees, which make this sound, which help you remember the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And there are birds there, which in their chirps, it helps you recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So it's basically the ultimate place for practicing the Buddha Dhamma. And so that's a brief introduction to Sukhavati, or the land of ultimate bliss, the pure land of Amitabha. And how it ties into the reappearance by aspiration is that in that sutta, Majjhima number 120, the Buddha says, take a practitioner who has a certain level of faith, virtue, learning, generosity, wisdom, and they think, if only when my body breaks up after death, I would be reborn in the company of devas. So, and then in this sutta, the Buddha goes through the whole, well, he starts off with, someone can think, may I be reborn as a wealthy Brahmin or a wealthy merchant, and then may I be reborn in the level of, you know, all these different ascending hierarchy choirs of angels, of devas. Then, if they've got that certain level of faith, virtue, learning, generosity, wisdom, and they have this wish, if only aho is the kind of what you, aho, if only I was born there, then they settle their mind on that thought, they concentrate it and they develop it, they place their mind on it, they aditana, they concentrate on it, or they create this vow. Then those choices and meditations of theirs developed and cultivated this lead to rebirth in those various different realms. So that's reappearance by aspiration, or sankhara, in the Theravada canon. And it goes all the way up through many different levels. Very interesting. It introduces these certain levels of Brahmin who know the whole field of their universe. They know their whole universe and all the beings of this universe. So this is very much like the portrait that you get of Amitabha or Guanyin. These are bodhisattvas or Buddhas, Buddha, bodhisattva, who know whole realms and the thoughts of all the beings in those realms. Hence, if I have a thought, Namo Amitabha, praising Amitabha Buddha, then he can hear that. Well, that's the postulate, the premise of the Mahayana presentation of the Sukhavati. But here in the Sutta of Theravada, we've got these Brahmas who can do the same thing. And it goes all the way up through all these levels of devas. And another interesting thing about the, just jumping over real quickly, please forgive me, to the, back to the pure lands, the Sukhavati of Mahayana Buddhism. One of the other great things about it is that you want to be generous, and there are all these opportunities. There are all these Buddhas, other Buddhas, who live in Sukhavati, and you can make offerings to them, which is great. Not only do you hear the Dhamma, you have offerings, you can make offerings and be generous to Buddhas, which is a great form of making offerings. So that's where, that's another reason why one would want to be reborn in the Sukhavati. And the this Majjhima Sutta then ends by saying, and then again, this is where the diehard Theravadins will once again become happy with me, because this is how the Buddha ends, and they say, or they think, if only I might realize the undefiled freedom and freedom of wisdom in this very life and live having realized it with my own insight due to the ending of defilements. Aho vataham asavanam kaya anasavanam chito vimuting panya vimuting Diteva dhammesayan abhinya sachikatava upasampaja viharanti. So that's a wish. And the Buddha says, and they can realize that truth somewhat based on this desire. So this is using desire, using this thought, using this aspiration to put an end to aspiration, using desire to put an end to desire, which is very much a Theravada approach and the Mahayana approach, using this wish to be reborn in the land of Amitabha so that you can become a Buddha. And it's, yeah, a general tendency and a pitfall, a danger of Theravada, that we lean in the direction of non-becoming. So the cause of suffering in a Theravada, in the Four Noble Truths, is said to be craving. Craving for what? Craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. As Theravadins, we're apt to crave for non-becoming. I hate samsara. I hate everything in samsara. If you praise samsara, anything in samsara, I kind of hate that view, and I kind of hate you for saying it. In a Mahayana approach, there's the tendency, a possible tendency, or a pitfall, a danger of the craving for becoming. So, yeah. But can one use becoming to put an end to becoming? That is what the practice of Pure Land Buddhism is purporting to do. And is it possible that someone, through reciting Amitabha's name for 8 or 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day plus, I've been to these Amitabha retreats where that's literally what people are doing all day long for 3 days, 7 days, 10 days, or their whole life. People take this as their whole Dhamma door, and you're reciting this, that one could enter a level of samadhi? Definitely. If one can get their mind around, yeah, I might be reborn in this heaven realm if I recite this name a lot. That's, for some people, a lot easier to get their mind around than saying, oh, I'm going to look at the breath because maybe I'll achieve enlightenment based on that, which the Buddha said you can do if you're wise about it. But that doesn't pull everyone. So is this a skillful means? Does the Pure Land actually exist? I don't know. I've never been there. And neither has the Buddha has never been reborn in the pure abodes, because if he was reborn there, then he would have to attain, he did attain arhantship there. So that's one realm in which the Buddha has not been born. But just in summary, before we open it up for questions, and I invite anyone to put questions in the chat, one very useful way of taking this concept of the Pure Land into one's Theravada practice is this: in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind. And just taking this term of the Suddhavasa or Sukhavati as being a placeholder for whatever the optimal birth is. So I know one Theravada teacher who actually recommends spending time on thinking about what your future birth might be, because as much as we might want it, the conditions might not be there for us to achieve our arhatship in this life. So yeah, having this wish, if only I might realize the undefiled freedom of heart and freedom of wisdom in this very life, and having realized it with my own sight, realize Nibbana, basically. But as a second best, may I be reborn in the best place for enlightenment. And if Sukhavati exists, then may I be born there, because there's no backsliding. That's a similar characteristic between the Sukhavati of Mahayana and the Suddhavasa of the pure abodes in Theravada, is that there's no backsliding. It's a safe birth. And yeah, where's the best place for cultivating Dhamma? May I be born there. If I'm going to be born, if I don't achieve arhatship in this life, then may I be reborn in the optimal place. And I can call that Sukhavati. I can call that whatever I want, but then inclining towards that. And yeah, I don't think that's, the Buddha allowed for that. This whole sutta, the Sankhara Upapatti Sutta, reappearance by aspiration, it's not, it doesn't say one can think, may I be when my body breaks up after death, oh, that I would be reborn in the company of devas. The Buddha doesn't just then, before he gets to arhatship, say in that sutta, in the listing of the sutta, say, and all of those wishes for a heavenly birth are totally wrong, and you guys are idiots for thinking it. He doesn't say that. He just goes on to present this, the highest piece of Nibbana after that. So with that, I turn things over to you and see what people have questions about. So from you, Ajahn, is it true if someone offers alms to an arhat, then he is guaranteed rebirth in a deva realms? I have never heard that, and I am almost positive it doesn't, that's never said anywhere in the Pali Canon, just because of the complicatedness of karma, and just I would find that hard to believe, just based on how complicated karma or kama is. We're planting so many kamic seeds all the time, every moment that we're living in the world, we're planting karmic seeds. And the idea that just from offering a bit of sticky rice or something else into an arahant's bowl, that you could be guaranteed rebirth as a deva. Elsewhere there's this sutta that the Buddha says that in one way, you know, predicting birth for many people is like throwing a stick up in the air. You can't say, is it going to land on this end? Is it going to land on that end? Is it going to land in the middle? Because we have not only seeds of our karma from this life, but seeds of karma from previous lives. So, it is not the case, actually. I can say that because, say, I offer alms to an arahant today, but then I kill my mother, or I kill my father, or I kill an arahant, or I cause a schism in the Sangha. Those are all what are called the fixed destiny karmas. So one goes straight to hell if they do any of those actions in this life. After they die, they go to hell, rebirth in hell. So it's great karma, it's fantastic karma, and it's, the Buddha does talk about different levels of ways of giving and the value of what one is. If you give to a human, that's higher than giving to an animal, the Buddha says in the Theravada Canon. Or if you give to someone who's virtuous, that's a merit which is of a meritorious kind, different from, and in the sutta, several suttas, the Buddha says superior to giving to someone who maybe doesn't have sila in their hearts. And similarly, giving to an arhat is a really high type of dana. But the Buddha continues in the one of the last several suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya. The Buddha talks about the different levels and superior levels and types of giving, and says that giving to a Buddha is better than giving to an arhat, but even better than giving to a Buddha is giving to a Sangha. So, long answer, but good question. Okay. In Theravada, I have never heard of the idea of a bardo, antarabhava. So where does our soul go in between death and rebirth? Thank you, Ajahn. The word bardo, of course, doesn't exist in Theravada Buddhism, but there is this concept of an antara existence that incurs, or antara state that appears in some suttas. And where that is, what level of existence that is, it's definitely not gone into specifically. I believe it occurs in poetry or in verse, which is a different genre than when the Buddha's very clearly defining terms. So it's not defined very clearly in the oldest strata of the Pali Canon. So whereas the soul, obviously, yeah, in a Theravada context, we don't speak of souls or this atta. There are places where the Buddha talks about the consciousness or the gandhaba, the vijnana, descending into the womb of a mother. But where that is between death and rebirth, this can be answered on an abhidhamic level, that there's just these mind moments that you have your pre-death mind moment, and then, yeah, I shouldn't even try to go into explaining the abhidhamma conception of it because I don't actually understand it that well. But yeah, where it goes is not stated in a Theravada context, but in these suttas, it is that do mention this interim state. It is said that you can share merit with beings in that state. So yeah, if you've someone you know has just passed away, you can share merit. That is, if you've done something good, or as you're making an offering, or you can dedicate that, may this go to beings in this, if there is an interim state, to the interim state. And the Buddha very clearly said that that is for the good of the person who's doing that dedication. So, if I'm recalling correctly, bardo is a concept that originates from the indigenous Tibetan Bon tradition, which kind of merged with the Buddhism, for lack of a better term. Bardo, I'm not sure if, I was aware of it in the Tibetan Bon tradition, but I'm not sure if bardo, it sounds like it might be from a Western language as well. But it definitely appears and is elaborated upon both in Tibetan Buddhism and in Chinese Buddhism. You've got this concept that there's either a 7 or 49-day period before someone is reborn. Theravada doesn't talk about it in that, certainly not in those explicit and specific ways. Dear Ajahn, how can I work with sloth and torpor in my journey to meditation? Many merits to you. Yeah, with sloth and torpor, very good question. One of the techniques is bringing light, the aloka sanya, the perception of light, to mind. So that can be actually opening your eyes in meditation. This is perhaps the best thing that you can do, is just keep your eyes open. And if you can't keep your eyes open, then you might want to actually sit up, either sit in a chair or stand up. Actually looking at a light source, if you're it's during the day, getting up and looking outside, looking at the sky. If it's nighttime, looking up at the sky, looking up at the moon or the stars, that can help. And yeah, I think that technique of just opening your eyes, there is a way to tune into the perception of light with your eyes closed, but if you're tired, that's not the time to do it. Opening your eyes, and that will, the physicality of just keeping your eyes open, your eyelids from closing, is a measure of effort and a measure of mindfulness. Your task at that time is, yeah, I'm paying attention to keeping my eyes open. And if you can equate that physiological gesture of just keeping the eyelids open with an attempt towards awake awareness and towards being mindful, putting aside greed and anger. And that's one thing also to watch out with sloth and torpor. The Buddha said that one of the causes for sloth and torpor is a bad posture. You can fix your posture. Another one is arati, or which is discontent or leaning in the direction of aversion. So to what extent is your mind disliking the sloth and torpor? And to what extent is your mind disliking anything else, the pain of being tired? And so work with it and see if it's, have you actually gotten enough sleep? Do you have a sleep debt? In which case, yeah, you might take a nap. But if it's not the case, you've gotten enough sleep, you don't have a sleep debt, then yeah, finding these other ways to work around it. So I wish you the best. All right. So I will close the session now, and we'll, people who are so inclined can join our session over on Zoom, which I'll post the link into the chat. And just as a encouragement for anyone who's interested, Venerable Gina Siri, who is tuning in now. Does the last mind moment determine the next rebirth? Well, I think Gina Siri will actually be joining us over on Zoom, so we can continue the conversation about rebirth, or Venerable Gina Siri is the Tudong, or walking pilgrimage monk who currently living in Sri Lanka, who Ajahn Nisibo had a conversation with last week or week before that, something like that. So everyone is welcome to come over to Zoom, and we'll continue the conversation over there. And I hope people can join, and I'll be there in person at St. Mark's Cathedral this Saturday, and you're all welcome, and hope to see you there. And Ajahn Nisibo or I will be back next Wednesday. So wish everybody well, and hope you have a good evening, and hope to see you over on Zoom.